listening to Slime on CITR 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the University of British Columbia on traditional, ancestral, and unceded Musqueam territory. This is a podcast series about science in the news and on campus. I'm Annie.
And I'm Pablo. Nice to meet you. I am currently studying my master's in immunology at UBC, and I love penguins.
And I just graduated from the Master of Journalism program here. Together, we used to TA a course about communicating science for a bunch of different audiences.
This show is about fantastic, ongoing student research on campus and the most phenomenal science in the news. We also talk about funny and quirky aspects of science before ending the show with some history.
And even if you don't know much about science, there will be something for you in this show. So let's get to it. Time for the news roundup.
Let's begin with a hot topic. We're going to the sun.
That was such an easy joke. But we aren't actually going. The Parker Solar Probe is going. This probe, named after the solar astrophysicist Eugene Parker, was launched in August 2018 and is currently heading to the sun's corona, something that's never been done before.
The solar corona is kind of an aura that surrounds the sun and extends millions of kilometers into outer space. You know those mystical rays that are visible around the sun during a total eclipse? Well, that's the corona.
And for some reason, this region is actually hotter than the sun's surface, which is already about 5,500 degrees Celsius.
The corona is between 1 and 3 million degrees Celsius. And although there are very interesting theories about it, nobody knows why. The Parker probe is carrying many cool instruments along with some sunscreen to figure this out.
It will travel up to 690,000 kilometers per hour, which means it could get from Vancouver to Seattle within 1 second. 1 second, that's crazy.
This probe will be the closest we have ever been to our own star. It will approach the solar surface within 6 million kilometers, which sounds far, but Mercury, the closest planet to the sun, is 56 million kilometers away.
When you put it like that, it sounds a lot closer.
Humanity is on its way to learn more about this intriguing region, and you, dear listeners, now know that NASA has sent the first probe to the sun.
Visit the Parker Solar Probe website to learn more.
Annie, what's next?
Well, vaccines have been in the news a lot lately, so let's talk about that. You study immunology, Pablo, so tell me what vaccines do.
Ah, this is my thing. Vaccines provide a very fast immunization against infectious agents such as viruses or bacteria, so that our bodies can efficiently eliminate them upon a second encounter. That is what we call immunological memory. They have certainly changed the world.
So what if I told you that there's a vaccine against lung cancer?
Is there, though? Cancer is a non-infectious disease, doesn't involve viruses or bacteria. Due to a wide range of factors, most of them unknown, your own cells begin to multiply abnormally, leading to the formation of a malignant tumor. So tell us more about this lung cancer vaccine.
It's called Cimavax EGF, and it has been entirely developed in Cuba. I heard about it for the first time while traveling there recently.
Hooray to the Cuban health system.
And from what I understand, Cimavax is designed against non-small cell lung cancer, which accounts for 80 to 90% of all lung cancer cases. Is that right?
Yes, that's definitely the most common type of lung cancer.
The first clinical studies started in 1995, and in 2008, the Cuban regulatory agency licensed it as an alternative treatment for the disease.
Meaning that in 2008, Cimavax became the first ever lung cancer vaccine in the world.
There's an ongoing clinical trial in its fourth phase with over 1,000 patients in Cuba. This is the most advanced phase in the process of vaccine development, where the vaccine has already been licensed but is still being tested. It's called post-market surveillance.
Also, a second phase study where the vaccine is combined with different treatments is being carried out in the US as we speak. Let me highlight that this novel treatment doesn't cure lung cancer, but it does weaken the tumor, making it more vulnerable to standard therapies.
So, Pablo, can you explain the nitty-gritty of how this actually works? It sounds amazing, but what does EGF in the vaccine's name stand for?
EGF stands for epidermal growth factor. It is a very important protein that allows cells to grow and divide, and on top of that, it also prolongs the cell's life.
So all those seem to be good things. Why is this vaccine immunizing us against EGF?
lung cancer cells seem to rely heavily on EGF to multiply, more so than our normal cells. Imagine I need 7 cups of coffee every day to feel awake, and you only need one. When Tim Hortons is closed, there is no coffee for either of us. Now, this is a bigger problem for me, because although we can both switch to tea, I'll feel more tired than you.
Okay, no wonder if you were drinking 7 cups a day. So we all have this EGF protein in our bodies that lung cancer cells seem to love. How can this vaccine reduce the levels of EGF?
Easy. Every vaccine's goal is to make the immune system produce antibodies against whatever target we're choosing. In this case, the target is EGF. Your body naturally generates these proteins, antibodies, that will stick to EGF, and that will prevent EGF from binding to its specific receptor in the cancer cells.
I see. So let me get this straight. The signal that promotes survival, growth, and cell division will be blocked, and the tumor growth will slow down because EGF won't bind to its receptor in the cancer cells.
Exactly. And a slow-growing tumor is vulnerable to fierce anti-cancer therapies like chemotherapy.
But I still have a question. If EGF is in our bodies, so it's not foreign like a virus or bacteria, what makes our immune system attack EGF?
That's actually a really good point. Injecting EGF alone will not get an immune response. Why would it? It's part of our bodies. That is why vaccines use adjuvants. These are substances that make your immune system go nuts. If you chemically link an adjuvant to EGF, you're basically channeling all that crazy activated immune system only against EGF. This is a very common and sophisticated vaccination technique.
Thanks for explaining the science, Pablo. One last thing I wanted to point out was that this vaccine development is born from the first ever biotech venture between Cuba and the U.S., where the Havana-based Center for Molecular Immunology partnered up with Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in Buffalo, New York.
Wow. Progress at its finest.
If you listeners like to hear about health sciences, stick around for the upcoming interview. Well, Pablo, I think we've heard enough of our own voices. Time to bring in our guest?
Yeah, for sure. So this week in studio, we have Sophie Kitchen, a Master's of Science student in epidemiology. Funny story, we met each other at a speed-friending event at UBC during the first week of grad school.
Yeah, it's what you think it is. It's like speed dating, but for keen grad school kids who really needed friends. Thanks for coming in, Sophie.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So Sophie, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your research?
Sure. So my name's Sophie. I'm a second year master's science program in the School of Population and Public Health. And my research is on adverse drug events in the emergency department.
So what is an adverse drug event?
An adverse drug event is a pretty wide spectrum of things. It could be anything from an adverse drug reaction or an overdose or underdose. And this is all unintended and harmful consequences of prescription medications.
So how common are adverse drug events?
So adverse drug events actually result in 1 in 9 emergency department visits across Canada.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot.
And can you give us an example of a drug that commonly causes this?
Yeah, sure. So one of the most common drugs is warfarin. That's a very commonly prescribed medication for as a blood thinner for people who have heart disease. But it often results in adverse drug reactions that can be pretty severe and cause someone to have to come to the emergency department.
So what is your specific contribution to this area of research?
Yeah, that's a great question. Adverse drug events are a huge topic and cause a lot of unnecessary costs to the Canadian healthcare system. And so my thesis is really focused just on one intervention called a pharmacist-led medication review, in which pharmacists are introduced into the emergency department and they review high-risk patients for any drugs they think could be causing complications. And so my project is really evaluating the long-term outcomes of those people who receive that intervention.
And so what's been challenging about it so far?
I think one thing that's been really challenging is that when someone comes to the emergency department and if they have an adverse drug reaction, it could be a really serious allergic reaction, but you have to remember that everybody who is on that drug has a pre-existing medical condition and a reason to be on that drug. So you can't, if you're the pharmacist or physician, you can't just take them off that drug. And so I think it can cause I think it can be a really complicated problem to solve. And it's really interesting the decisions that the care providers are making in those moments.
And kind of on the flip side of that, what's something that's been really rewarding so far about your research?
I think one thing that my research group is really focused on is improving the continuity of care between the emergency department physicians and the primary care providers. And we know that by improving that relationship, it can help prevent repeat adverse drug events and improve health outcomes for those patients.
Was there something that you found really surprising that you didn't know before entering this program?
I think one thing was really just how common adverse drug events are. And I think one thing that I'm realizing now is while it seems like a pretty simple problem, I think it is a lot more complicated than it seems. So I'm really excited for the future of research and all the projects that people are working on now.
So you mentioned that you hope it's, impactful. How do you see your research like having a positive contribution to the health system, hopefully down the line?
Yeah, I think we definitely have a lot of potential to be helpful, and that's why I love public health in general. It's so focused on improving the health of people today. And so I think that a few of the interventions that my team is working on right now, top secret, but very exciting, I think they are going to definitely improve health outcomes for people. So
I look forward to hearing them when it's all not top secret.
Absolutely. You'll be the first to know.
Oh, thank you. One of the final questions was, from your research so far, are there recommendations that you can draw, or is that also top secret?
I think one thing that I mean, I don't know how qualified I am to tell people anything. I'm just a researcher, not a healthcare provider. But one thing that I think has been really interesting is learning about polypharmacy, or just how many drugs people are prescribed, and sometimes people don't always need that many. So I think it's really important for individuals to understand that drugs can be really helpful and beneficial to people, but they can also cause harm. And just thinking about what medications you're on and working with your primary care provider about weaning off some drugs that you may not need, that could be helpful.
Was there anything else you wanted to add about your research or kind of the problem in general that we didn't talk about?
I don't think so. I feel like I said everything.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming to chat with us today. And look forward to hearing about all the top secret info come out eventually one day.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Now, that interview was a great learning experience.
Yeah, I didn't know too much about that topic before meeting Sophie, so I'm glad she was able to join us. And if you just tuned in, this is Slime on CITR 101.9 FM.
You know, Annie, I do research about the immune system, and it can get very busy and frustrating. I hope the research eventually leads to something positive, but as you're about to hear, science can sometimes take very peculiar paths.
And that's totally fine. It's a fundamental part of the process. But that doesn't mean we won't laugh at it occasionally. Like the Belgian chemist Jan-Baptiste van Helmont, for example. He was a pioneer in biochemistry, medicine, and botanics. And the inventor of the word gas.
Wait, what?
Yep, you heard it. He realized multiple gases exist, including carbon dioxide, and came up with the general term gas. But it gets a lot wilder. He also believed in this thing called spontaneous generation.
Spontaneous generation means that living organisms can spontaneously arise from non-living matter. Of course, this was in the 17th century.
Van Helmont was so convinced of this theory that he proposed a recipe to generate mice. It was published in his book, Ordus Medicinae, which came out after his death in 1648.
Allow me to give you a summary of his observations. If you put sweaty clothes with wheat in an open container for 21 days, it will get smelly, of course, and the fermentation coming from the clothes will convert the wheat into mice. The most fascinating observation is that the mice can be male and female and can be crossed with other mice that have been born in a normal way. Normal as not being born from poop.
Thanks, Pablo. But the most interesting thing is that these mice derived from wheat and sweaty clothes aren't born as infants. In fact, they are perfect adults.
Why did he believe this? At the time, science could not explain the origins of all these life forms, including mice. So this seemed a viable alternative, right? Anyhow, I should do my laundry today, just in case.
So according to Van Helmont, if you don't wash your clothes and leave them next to your bread-making materials for 3 weeks, you might end up with some extra furry friends. As crazy as this sounds, it arose from Van Helmont's curiosity.
Look, curiosity killed the cat, and we need the cat alive to hunt all of those spontaneously generated mice.
But what I'm trying to say is that science has always been about mad theories. Some of them are right, some of them are wrong, but they always sound unconventional when they're first proposed. How do you think people reacted when Wilbur and Orville Wright decided they would build a flying machine called an airplane?
Or when Giordano Bruno suggested in the 16th century that the sun was just a star, like many others in the universe, and that was potentially full of habitable planets.
Pablo, he was burned alive.
Oh.
Basically, he denied several important Roman Catholic doctrines.
Anyway, science is for the mad. Don't be afraid to wonder. Dive into the depths of imagination. Who knows what ideas will come out of that? Nobody will burn you alive nowadays.
And if they laugh at your idea, you're probably on the right track. We like to end the show with a bit of history. What happened this week in science, decades ago?
So tell me, what happened way back when?
I remember learning about this event during a biology class in high school, and maybe an English or history class too.
In all three classes? Okay, this sounds promising.
Let me tell you about it. So on May 18th, 1967, just over 50 years ago, the governor of Tennessee repealed the Butler Act, a law that made it illegal to teach evolution in state-funded schools.
So what exactly did the law say?
Let me tell you. Quote, "It shall be unlawful for any teacher in any of the universities, normals, and all other public schools of the state, which are supported in whole or in part by the public school funds of the state, to teach any theory that denies the story of divine creation of man, as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man has descended from a lower order of animals." End quote. So, the Butler Act was challenged in court by a high school biology teacher named John T. Scopes. The famous trial became known as the Scopes Monkey Trial and gained huge national publicity. More than 100 newspaper reporters filled the courtroom daily.
That is a lot of newspaper reporters. But the trial was actually a test case. An organization called the American Civil Liberties Union asked Scopes if he would be willing to challenge the law in court. Even though Scopes couldn't remember if he'd actually taught evolution, he believed in it and agreed.
People flocked to Dayton, Tennessee to witness the trial, which had star lawyers on both sides. Scopes had one of America's top criminal defense lawyers, and the state was represented by a famous politician and known anti-evolutionist. And at the end of the trial, Scopes was charged for violating the Butler Act. He had to pay a fine of $100, but was later acquitted of the charge on a technicality. The law stayed in place for over four more decades, but even without the Butler Act, evolution can still be challenging to teach. A 2014 study from the Pew Research Center found that 98% of American scientists accepted evolution, but only 62% of the American general public agreed. A creationist perspective was preferred by 34% of people.
Imagine Thanksgiving dinner with your extended family. There is a 100% chance that Uncle Steve is bound to disagree with Uncle Charlie on at least one controversial topic. Now, scale that up to a courtroom with multiple uncles, and you might begin to have an idea of what took place during the Scopes trials. If you want to learn more, You can find the info at aclu.org, or watch the film about the SCOPES trial by Stanley Kramer, Inherit the Wind. Well, that's a wrap on SLIME this week. Thanks for listening to our show on CITR 101.9 FM. Next time, we will take you into my kitchen for an at-home science experiment. I mean, what could go wrong?